Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over 5 recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top 5 countdown for the week. At number 5, we have India's de facto ban on cow slaughter. The central government in New Delhi issued a nationwide decree which all but makes it impossible for anyone in India to sell a cow for slaughter, whether it's for food or leather. In fact, Prime Minister Modi's home state in Gujarat just raised the maximum term in jail for killing a cow to life in prison. The reason why India takes what is otherwise an ordinary and commonplace act in almost every other country in the world so seriously is because pious Hindus believe that cows are holy, and the ruling BJP is a Hindu nationalist party which emerged from the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, or RSS, radical religious organization. The strict centralized enforcement of what's a religious, cultural, and culinary practice is at extreme variance with India's federalized administrative state and constitutionally secular nature, which is why so many people are concerned about this sudden but unsurprising move. Another thing to keep in mind is that India is thought by some estimates to have nearly as many, if not more, Muslims than Pakistan, and that the approximately 170 million followers of Islam in India are heavily involved in the cattle slaughter industries, whether as active participants in the trade or passive consumers of its beef and leather products. Therefore, the de facto cow slaughter ban disproportionately affects them, their livelihoods, and lifestyles much more than any other community in the country. Moreover, so-called gau rakshaks, or cow vigilantes, have lately committed several high-profile murders of people who they accused of killing cows. And this cuts beyond religious lines to even include intra-Hindu violence as per the millennia-old caste system of social stratification which is still commonly practiced in India today. Dalits, the lowest caste and sometimes referred to as untouchables, are also sometimes involved in the cow slaughter industry. And their killings at the hands of radicalized Hindus further aggravates the already fraught intra-communal tensions across India. From all of this, we can conclude that the effective cow slaughter ban is already leading to several undesirable consequences in India. The first one is that the $10 billion cattle-related industry is crippled, and that this could possibly contribute to slowing down the Indian economy even further than it already is. India still has a very high growth rate of 6.1% for the last quarter of 2016, but this figure is a revised and downscaled one from what was previously reported before, therefore making China once more the world's fastest growing economy and taking the ephemeral crown away from India. Developments can be expected to proceed along this trajectory when one accounts for the structural effects of the government's so-called demonetization policy, and now the economic impact of the cattle industry's looming collapse. The next consequence related to this de facto ban is that communal tensions might surge because a legally secular state is essentially implementing religious and discriminatory legislation. And finally, the last major expected outcome from the cow slaughter prohibition is that states such as Kerala and West Bengal are rising up in opposition against what they believe to be the national government's unconstitutional violation of the country's federalism, thereby possibly setting in motion more pronounced centrifugal processes which could lead to further political complications for the centralizing authorities down the line. The next one up is Russia's successful test firing of the Zircon hypersonic missile. The armament itself isn't anything new and was reported on earlier this year, but just the other day, Western press picked up on an article by Russian military journalist and Svobodnaya Pressa contributor Vladimir Tuchkov, which offered some important strategic details about this missile, including the fact that Russia is presently testing it and expects to deploy the munition between the next 1 to 3 years. The firestorm that set this off in the Western media was that Russia is beating the U.S. in the modern-day hypersonic arms race and can now nullify the billions of dollars worth of investments that the Pentagon has made over the decade in so-called missile defense shields. Furthermore, the Zircon missile can also pretty much turn all of the U.S.'s aircraft carriers into sitting ducks, thereby prompting a fundamental rethinking of American naval strategy in the years ahead. I welcome you all to read the Sputnik article titled Race for Hypersonic Superiority, Russia Over Half a Decade Ahead of the U.S., if you want more details about the ins and outs of the Zircon missile. But for the rest of this segment, I want to fill you folks in on some of the larger context behind this program, and what its accelerated deployment to the Russian armed forces means for the global balance of power. The modern-day arms race that I referred to about a minute ago deals with hypersonic weaponry, or in other words, armaments which travel many times faster than the speed of sound. They're thought to be the only way to counter state-of-the-art anti-missile defense systems and therefore preserve the existing nuclear balance between Russia and the U.S., which makes them less of an offensive weapon and more of a defensive one when you really think about it. And that's what we need to focus on, folks. It's nuclear parity and the enduring concept of mutually assured destruction, or MAD. The only reason why the U.S. and Russia haven't had a hot war yet is because both sides know that the other still retains the credible potential to launch a nuclear second strike. But if that reassurance is removed because one side, in this case the U.S., can block the other from doing so, then it gives that party the confidence to initiate a nuclear first strike without worrying too much about any like-minded reprisal. In practice, this means that the U.S. as missile defense shield could eventually give the Pentagon the security that it needs to attack Russia with overwhelming conventional and even nuclear force and be certain that Moscow cannot respond in kind. The very threat of the state of affairs and consequent geopolitical blackmail becoming a reality in the next couple of decades prompted Russian researchers to prioritize hypersonic missiles and other modern-day arms race munitions in order to preserve their country's strategic sovereignty. So if you come across reports that Russia just destabilized the global balance of power, don't believe them. What Russia really did was stabilize the situation and delay the prospects of nuclear war. Third in our countdown are the leaked emails from the UAE ambassador to the U.S. Mr. Yusuf al-Otaiba's Hotmail account was hacked recently by an organization calling itself Global Leaks, and the revelation suggests that the country, which American military officials called Little Sparta in 2014, is also a Little Machiavelli. According to the leaks, which have yet to be verified, Mr. Otaiba strongly criticized now U.S. President Donald Trump on several occasions before the former entered into office in correspondences that he shared with Obama-era officials. This is embarrassing, but not Machiavellian. So let me get to what's most pertinent right now and explain why Abu Dhabi might have had a secret hand in sparking the Qatari-Saudi Cold War. Some of the reports that have come out of this leak claim to prove that Ambassador Otaiba is very close with the pro-Israeli Foundation for the Defense of Democracy's think tank, and that he's actively worked to discredit Qatar's reputation in the eyes of American decision-makers. This stems from the competition that both neighboring Gulf states have with one another. So considering this, it can't be discounted that the UAE whispered in Trump and King Salman's ear and convinced them to pin the blame for Wahhabi terrorism all across the Mideast solely on its Qatari rival, spicing things up by adding Iran to the mix, which the UAE is reportedly obsessed with, according to the leaks, could lend the so-called plausible justification necessary for getting the Sunni NATO to coordinate a crippling asymmetrical attack against Qatar, which is what the de facto embargo essentially amounts to. Another thing is that the UAE and Qatar are on opposite sides of the Libyan civil war, which explains why General Haftar's eastern government in Tobruk cut ties with Qatar, though the UN recognized one in Tripoli didn't. It could be that the UAE wants to completely crush its Qatari rival now that the fortunes of war have begun to shift in Abu Dhabi's direction, and that this is what's behind the country's crusade in focusing on Doha's enduring relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood. The Saudis, for their part, would probably have been happy to go along with this because of the irritation that they felt over the years as LNG-rich Qatar drifted out of its political orbit and began to craft a more independent foreign policy, whether manifested by challenging the kingdom's Wahhabi proxies all throughout the Mideast or charting pragmatic relations with its cross-Gulf Iranian neighbor. As for the U.S., we can already see by some of Trump's latest tweets about the issue that he's taking credit for this crisis, by implying that the Arab NATO heeded his advice to crack down on terror supporters within their ranks, so the American leader is able to score some political points by extent. Ultimately, however, the longer that the Qatari-Saudi Cold War drags on for, the more that the UAE cynically benefits because it's able to crush its rival's rich economy and divert some of the fleeing investment to its own ever-growing marketplace, which just became a lot more attractive by comparison. Our runner-up is the U.S.'s false allegations that Russian intelligence agencies conspired to destabilize the Republic of Macedonia. A report from the Soros and State Department-funded Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project alleges that Russian diplomats were secretly spies and sought to wage a prolonged propaganda war against the country together with their Serbian allies. The organization says that Russia sought to use a combination of civilizational soft power, as expressed through Slavic and Orthodox unity, alongside energy diplomacy to make Macedonia dependent on Moscow and prevent its future incorporation into NATO. Russia strongly objected to the report's unsubstantiated claims, and the foreign ministry said that, quote, groundless accusations against Moscow of financing Macedonian media with an aim of spreading disinformation in Russian interest come from the organization, which is mainly sponsored by U.S. state structures and George Soros' fund. End quote. We should also bear in mind that it wasn't ever Russia which contributed to any sort of destabilization in Macedonia, but the State Department and Soros Foundation themselves, the very same groups financing the report, slinging mud against Russia for what the U.S. has been doing over the years. The Republic of Macedonia has been paralyzed by a prolonged political crisis which started when American intelligence agencies secretly recorded thousands of political and civil society figures in the country and leaked the tapes to the then opposition in a false flag attempt to implicate former Prime Minister Nikola Gruevski for illegal and unethical wiretapping. Afterwards, Soros-funded NGOs organized two failed color revolutions in their attempt to topple him. But it was ultimately the work of sustained American diplomatic efforts which led to a phased regime change in the country and the installation of SDSM leader Zoran Zaev as the country's prime minister. The new leader's tenure has been marked by legitimate fears that he will follow through on the so-called Tirana platform to internally partition the country between Macedonians and Albanians, as under the guise of federalization. Russian and Serbian media warned about this plot for years, even before it was officially unveiled in the Albanian capital last December. So, now that he's in power, Zaev and his Albanian and American backers want to take revenge on Macedonian supporters abroad, and are therefore seeking to burn every bridge they can with Serbia and Russia. This bogus report is nothing more than an information warfare tool designed to do just that, and to also feed into the West manufactured narrative that a Russian threat exists in the Balkan, which can only be countered by more NATO expansionism. Greece has been standing in the way of Macedonia's accession into the bloc since 2008 because of a naming dispute. So this provocation is designed to also put pressure on Athens to back down from its demands and allow its northern neighbor to smoothly be absorbed into NATO under its constitutional name. Altogether, the U.S.'s plans to internally partition the Republic of Macedonia and incorporate it into NATO are designed to heighten the strategic risk to Russia and China's Balkan megaprojects, which are supposed to transit through the country, and therefore make them unattractive investments for these two multipolar great powers. At our top spot, we've got the start of Trump's war on leaks after the Department of Justice charged a federal contractor with printing and improperly removing classified information which was allegedly sent to The Intercept. According to news reports, Reality Lay Winner is a Georgia-based NSA contractor who purportedly printed off and mailed a classified report about Russia supposedly trying to hack into the U.S.'s election machines. I'm not even going to discuss how ridiculous of an assertion that is anyhow, other than to remind you all that the permanent military, intelligence, and diplomatic bureaucracies, or so-called deep state, are doing everything in their power to discredit President Trump's intentions to strike a new detente with Russia, even if they have to manufacture a paper trail of fake news to do so. But see, folks, this is relevant to bring up because that's why Trump declared his war on leaks in the first place. It's both to root out and eliminate the illegal disclosure of classified information from American security establishments, and to push back against the deep state's efforts to undermine his presidency. Now, what's the difference between a leak and treason? Good question, and you know what? It's hard to tell, and I don't think there's any golden rule or single standard to follow. It really all depends on a case-by-case basis. Take Bradley, now Chelsea Manning. What he did was amazing in my opinion because he proved that U.S. soldiers were literally getting away with murder in Iraq. However, he was in prison because of this and for also leaking countless other State Department cables. Did the public have a right to know what their government was up to overseas? You betcha, which is why it was admirable. But did it harm the state's interest? Absolutely, which is why it was illegal. Or for another example, folks, let's talk about Edward Snowden. He did more than any other man in history to prove that many so-called conspiracy theories about the U.S. government ubiquitously spying on its own people were actually true. Though, while being held up as a patriot by many, he slammed as a traitor by the state. President Putin shared some interesting insight on Snowden to director Oliver Stone when he said that the whistleblower wasn't a traitor because, quote, he did not betray the interests of the state, nor did he transfer information to any other country, unquote. But that what he did was, as the president put it, wrong, and he should have resigned if he didn't like his work. So, what we can conclude from all this is that there's a very fine line between treason and whistleblowing when it comes to leaks, and that it all depends on the individual's intentions. The first are weaponized disclosures, whether real, manipulated, or manufactured, which aim to deliberately harm state interest abroad, while the second are meant to inform the public about a potentially unethical or maybe even illegal practice and spark an active discourse on the topic within the given national democracy. That being said, I'll leave it up to you folks to decide whether Trump's war on leaks is a war on traitors or a war on whistleblowers. All right, folks, well, there you have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown. And as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for listening to my program. Hope you guys have a nice weekend and that you'll tune in again next week. Thanks. Bye.